This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Go ahead and raise your hand if your name is John Williams, huh? You might be the lucky winner of a big new job in monetary policy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 3rd of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are probably tens of thousands of people in this country named John Williams. The Star Wars and many other movies composer is, of course, one of them. A guy who is going to have a whole lot of influence on this economy is another. That John Williams was named today as the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Gina Smilek covers the Fed for Bloomberg News. Gina, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. First things first, who is this guy, John Williams?
So John Williams is the incumbent president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and he's also a longtime Fed economist. He worked at the Fed board in Washington before he moved out to San Francisco.
The job he is getting as of today, it's been rumored for a while, is arguably maybe other than the chairman of the Board of Governors in Washington, the most important job within the Federal Reserve System. Explain why the head of the New York Fed matters.
There are a couple of reasons why this is such an important job. The first, and perhaps the most obvious, is that the New York Fed president has a constant vote on monetary policy, which differs from the other 11 regional banks because they all operate on sort of a rotating schedule. It's also a really important job because the New York Fed president has oversight of supervision mm-hmm. of some of the most important banks in the world because they're sitting on Wall Street. And they act as a liaison with those banks in times of crisis. And then added to that, they by tradition work really closely with the Fed chair. And so that makes them sort of a key player on the Federal Open Market Committee.
We ought to mention here that John Williams is actually an economist. Jay Powell, the chair of the Fed, is not. And that would seem to matter in this instance.
Absolutely. I think that that makes John Williams a lot more important because what we know about Jay Powell is that he's rumored to be a great listener. You know, he really talks to his staff. And so I think if he's got a person in this role who has an expertise where he's lacking, it's probably going to make that person all the more important to shaping his opinions.
And he's also, it should be mentioned here, because he is an economist, he's not a banker. And one of the criticisms of people who've been running the New York Fed and regulating banks is that, you know, they've been too tight with the banks because they're coming from the banking world.
Right. This revolving door problem is something that you hear a lot, especially when you talk about the New York Fed. So I do think it probably helps optically that he has no ties to big banks.
All right. So here's another thing that Williams is. He is yet another white guy running or participating in monetary policy. There is no shortage of white guys now and for a long time. This appointment has been criticized by Cory Booker from New Jersey and Elizabeth Warren and many, many others who say, listen, this is a chance and opportunity, especially with Janet Yellen gone, to have some diversity at the Fed.
So the optics of this appointment are not all good. What was a diverse process and promised to be transparent and consider a lot of women and minorities ended in a white insider who's sort of been around the Fed for quite some time. And so I think that that's probably something you're going to continue to hear in the days ahead, just sort of this backlash around this appointment.
Do you expect any actual changes in policy with Williams?
So the thing about Williams is he already has a seat at the table. And so I don't think what we would expect from this is any kind of dramatic shift in the way the Fed's thinking. What could get elevated a little bit, though, is he has been really pushing the Fed to reconsider its inflation target. So I think that longer term discussion could get a little bit more attention now that he is in a more powerful role.
Yeah. And that thing the Fed looks at, one of the two things that it's supposed to concentrate on is, of course, inflation and consistent prices. Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Gina. Imagine John Williams running the New York Fed when some kind of economic crisis hits, much like Tim Geithner did 10 years ago. Do you think he's up to it?
So John Williams, I've been covering John Williams for years. He certainly does seem to be someone who's really attentive, and he's clearly smart based on his record. At the same time, you know, there has been a lot of criticism over the fact that he hasn't spent a lot of time working in markets. And so that is one concern. That said, the Fed will push back on that and say his research shows he understands it. So I think it kind of remains to be seen.
Gina Smilak, she covers the Fed at Bloomberg News. Gina, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
The tweet of the day today from a man again perspective was this afternoon from Google Communications re-YouTube situation. It said, "We're coordinating with authorities and we'll provide official information here from Google and YouTube as it becomes available." A little bit before 1 Pacific time, as you might have heard, somebody started shooting at YouTube headquarters south of San Francisco. On Wall Street today, yeah, stocks traded. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got March car sales figures from Detroit today, and they were pretty good, really. General Motors, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler all did better this March than they did a year ago. The most interesting tidbit, though, was this. These might be the last monthly sales numbers we're going to get from GM. The company said from now on, it's only going to do quarterly reports. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what's going on.
Once, car makers put out sales numbers every 10 days, and that was a hassle, so they went to 20 days. For decades, it's been monthly. Jim Kane is a spokesman for General Motors. He says going quarterly is about giving better information.
The 30-day snapshot of sales makes it actually harder to follow the industry, not easier, and that's why we're changing.
He says monthly reports are vulnerable to a lot of noise, like
fleet sales and the weather and how many weekends there are in a particular month and on and on and on. If you look at things with a longer lens, a lens like 90 days, it really makes it a lot easier to spot the trends in the business that really matter.
How will analysts and investors respond to getting less data?
It's not as big of a deal, at the end of the day than I think the industry is initially thinking about it.
Jeff Schuster does forecasting at LMC Automotive. He says monthly reports are a lot of work, and other industries do fine without them.
Retail industry, for example, reports quarterly. You know, there are other manufacturers within the auto sector that report quarterly, like Tesla.
Still, Jessica Caldwell with auto research firm Edmunds says there is a risk in making investors jumpy.
The longer that you kind of extend that window of information you're giving people, the more runway you have for people to guess what's going on. And that could either be good or most of the times that is usually bad.
She says that risk will be lessened if competitors follow. GM's next report won't come until July. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
There was an interesting press release from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau yesterday. The acting director, Mick Mulvaney, who is doing double duty, as you might have heard, as the White House budget director, said, in essence, he's got too much power running the CFPB and he wants Congress to take some of it away. Mulvaney has been a huge critic of the agency he now leads, and he sent Congress a handful of recommendations he says should make the agency more accountable. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
The Bureau is far too powerful and with precious little oversight of its activities. So said Director Mulvaney in his semi-annual report to Congress this week. Among his recommendations, give the president more authority to oversee and remove the CFPB's director, require congressional approval of major Bureau rules, fund the agency with congressional appropriations instead of money from the Federal Reserve that Congress doesn't control.
They need to be more accountable to elected officials who are in turn accountable to the voters.
John Berla is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says these changes would make the CFPB more like other agencies.
It works for the Pentagon, the NSA, other agencies with critical missions. It could and should work for the CFPB.
But the CFPB was created with this structure to protect its independence, says Patricia McCoy, a law professor at Boston College who used to work at the CFPB.
Politicians, and particularly the White House, have a big temptation to relax consumer protection and relax bank regulation in order to goose the economy in the short term.
She says that's why other bank regulators, like the Federal Reserve or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, aren't funded by Congress either. So rather than making the CFPB more accountable, she thinks Mulvaney's proposed changes are about weakening the agency. That said, she doesn't think these changes will get through Congress. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Teachers in Oklahoma and Kentucky are continuing their walkouts and protests today, angry over spending cuts, low pay, and changes to pensions. This follows a win for teachers in West Virginia earlier this year, where they got a 5% pay increase after a 9-day strike. It is being called in some places the Red State Teacher Rebellion. As Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR.
Before legislators approved an average $6,000 raise last week, Oklahoma ranked near the bottom of states for teacher pay. But high school history teacher Joshua Smith says his bigger concern is funding for schools.
I've got 10-year-old textbooks, and I have some of the newer textbooks in the building. The desks are falling apart. We have to ration paper, or else we have to buy our own.
Smith says the recent win in West Virginia inspired Oklahoma teachers to walk out this week. Teachers in Arizona are also threatening to strike. These are red states where tax cuts have drained public coffers and where unions typically have less power to negotiate higher pay. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers.
What's happened is that 29 states in the United States actually spend less on public education today than they did before the 2008 recession.
And UC Berkeley economist Sylvia Allegretto says teachers are feeling the pain.
Teacher pay, after you adjust for price increases, has fallen over the last decade, while other college grads, their pay has increased.
Any gains from this surge of activism could be limited. Thomas Tock with the think tank Future Ed at Georgetown says with more than 3 million teachers in this country, making up the single largest profession,
to raise salaries dramatically would be a budget buster in most places.
Even after the pay raise in Oklahoma, its teachers would still fall well below the national average. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Quick thing before we move on. Despite the happy music you're going to get in a little bit here, we seem to be headed back into trade war is on territory. Late this afternoon, the U.S. Trade Representative came out with its list of tariff items that it wants to hit China with in return for Chinese intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer. 1,300 separate tariff lines, aerospace, information and communications technology, robotics and machinery. Hang on to your hats, gang. Even if you're not a big golf fan, and I count myself in your number, you can probably name at least one golfer. And the odds are real, real good that that golfer is Tiger Woods. Woods has been off his game in a very big way for a good long while now after a string of well-publicized personal struggles and 4 back surgeries in 3 years. But he is back and playing pretty well. And when Tiger's playing well, things are good in golf. TV ratings pick up, sponsors are happy, a rejuvenated golf economy, if you will. So with Woods back at the Masters this week, a tournament he has won 4 times, for the first time he's back since 2015, Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from KUT in Austin on a term that's become part of the sports marketing lexicon, the Tiger Effect.
Tiger Woods is part of a select group of people, and I'm not talking about those who routinely bomb the golf ball more than 300 yards off the tee. He's like Madonna, Oprah, and Beyonce. All you need is the first name. Jeff Benedict co-authored a new biography.
We refer to Tiger as a Shakespeare-like character in our book because he's someone that we've never seen before and we're never going to see another one like him again.
A couple of weeks ago, more people watched the normally low-profile Valspar Championship when it looked like Woods might win than 3 of the 4 major tournaments last year. Kevin Van Valkenburg is a senior writer at ESPN.
To a broader spectrum of people, Tiger still matters the most.
He still moves the needle almost 10 years after a sex scandal dominated headlines. Most of his sponsorship deals dried up. Woods has golf ball and club sponsors now, but not much else. Biographer Benedict says car companies, watchmakers, and other big firms will be paying attention this weekend because Woods' draw reaches far beyond golf fans.
There were times when he was at the peak of his career that golf outperformed the NBA and the NFL in the Nielsen ratings. That had never been done before, and it's never been done since.
Last year, without Tiger Woods in the field, the Masters had its lowest ratings in 13 years. Ryan Harrington is deputy editor at GolfDigest.com. He's at the Masters this week and says he thinks this year could be very different.
If his name is anywhere near the leaderboard on Saturday or Sunday, you're going to have just tremendous ratings.
Great news for broadcasters and sponsors. We could even see those companies on the sidelines jump back on the Tiger Woods bandwagon. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. All right, coming up.
It's a almost more of a listening enterprise as much as it is a writing enterprise.
Cookbooks as a job. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. After yesterday's dive, the Dow Industrials regained 1.6% today. That's about 389 points, 24,033. The NASDAQ pulled up 1%, 71 points, finished at 69.41. The S&P 500, 1.2% to the good, 32 points, wrapped up at 26.14. Spotify hit a high note on its first day as a public company. After a big early surge, shares ended the day trading up nearly 13%, 149.01 a share. That gives the company a market value of around $26 billion. Pandora, however, a different tune. Its shares reversed more than 3%. President Trump took another swipe at Amazon. Traders went, really? Amazon delivered a gain of 1.4%. We told you about the new normal coming to the CFPB. That was good news to banks. Wells Fargo up 1.4%. JPMorgan Chase deposited about 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The big government spending bill that passed a week or two ago was 2,232 pages long. Tucked deep inside was a provision telling the Government Accountability Office to have a look into why it costs so darn much to build public transit in New York City, where subway construction expenses are far and away the highest in the world. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports on where some of the blame is likely to land and what that might mean for the city.
There's a billboard just outside of Times Square right now on 8th Avenue.
Excuse me, miss.
Across the street, Edona Curlew is holding her lunch and a hard hat, waiting to cross. The billboard is made to look like a subway sign, black with white letters and icons, and it says,
"Dirty, delayed, and dangerous. Construction unions are screwing with your commute."
You look like you work in trades.
I do. Construction. I'm an electrician, actually.
Tell me what you think of that sign.
It's true.
Okay, not the answer I was expecting. But then Curlew's not a union member.
I'm planning to be, though, so.
Okay, cool. Sorry I made you miss the light.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm screwing with your commute.
Exactly.
The subways function as kind of a political punching bag in New York. And lately, trade unions are catching a lot of jabs.
I think the challenge that New York has is that we've got years, decades of high-cost habits.
Mitchell Moss directs the Rudin Center for Transportation Policy at NYU. He says construction unions are politically potent and tend to get their way, and that each one has its own crazy rules.
Not just overtime, but when does the workday start? What's paid? What isn't paid? Taking the elevator to the site is part of the pay. Taking the elevator during a coffee break is part of the pay. And so the entire structure of costs are ones which lead to overruns.
He also says there's little competition in construction bidding and that outside firms that contract the work have no incentive to reduce costs. Robert Paswell, who teaches engineering at the City College of New York and used to run the Chicago Transit Authority, says the Times story forced the Government Accountability Office to investigate.
So what will they be looking for?
They're going to be looking for what's state of good practice and what's deviation from state of good practice. How many people to do tunneling? How many people to do sheeting and bracing on a job? How many people to lay track?
Findings are due by the end of the year. Paswell says the GAO can't do anything besides make recommendations, but that if Congress takes them seriously, it could start to yank federal funding from New York's infrastructure projects, which is often up to half the money.
And money talks louder than anything else.
Oh, and how much money are we talking about with these inflated construction costs? 23-year-old Jacqueline Cebulski tried to guess how much the new subway line she takes to work costs to build. When she heard...
Oh my God, that makes me kind of want to throw up.
It costs nearly $3.5 billion per mile. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
We've talked about a whole lot of jobs on the program today. President of the New York Fed, professional golfer. Now, another cool one. Jessica Badalana is the author of a new cookbook. It's called Repertoire, All the Recipes You Need. But here's the thing. She's not really a chef. Here's our conversation. So I don't want to give away any secrets here, but I just now, before this little bit that we'll play on the air, I asked you, as I asked everybody, how you want to be identified. And you said San Francisco-based food writer and recipe developer. What is that job?
That's right.
What is that job, recipe developer?
It's a pretty good gig. So I've basically spent my entire professional career working in the food industry in various capacities. But what I like to do the most and what I think I do best is develop recipes. And so basically that entails cooking a dish that I sort of imagine over and over again until I think it tastes perfect.
Okay, that's either amazingly glamorous with you in a great sunlit kitchen and all kinds of, you know, handcrafted Italian machines and everything, or it's drudgery.
It's both. sometimes it's amazing, and things work on the first or second try. And sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes it takes 10 or 15 tries to get a recipe where you want it. And then I end up foisting leftovers on my UPS man, on my kids' teachers, you know, my neighbors. And it makes you seem like a real jerk when you say to them, like, oh, here, take this. It's not right.
Yeah, here are my rejects.
I'm going to give it to you.
Tell me what's wrong.
Here are my rejects.
On a day when you are deep into recipe development, you get out of bed, you have a cup of coffee, and then what do you do? What does that day look like?
Well, if I'm lucky, I go to the grocery store just once. But often, you know, it's a couple trips to the grocery store or trips to, you know, a few different stores to get a few different things. And then I get home and I, you know, I turn on the radio and I'll start to cook something. You know, I'll have like fish soup at 10 in the morning and then, you know, dessert at lunchtime and maybe dessert again in the afternoon if it didn't work out the first time.
Do you do one by one or do you have a lot of recipes going in at the same time?
I usually do one at a time so that I don't get mixed up. And, you know, I want to take notes for, you know, how long things are taking to cook in the pan or, you know, all of that. And so I have to kind of be paying some amount of attention. And I think if I get too much going on, the chance of me screwing something up goes up.
You and me both, man. You and me both.
Right.
How... this is going to sound like a silly question, but how aware do you have to be of what's happening in the food world? I mean, I imagine you read blogs and you talk to chefs and you do all that stuff to stay on trend is the phrase, right?
That is the phrase. you know, I think actually Repertoire is in some ways not a very trendy book. Of course, I know what's going on in the world. I know that there's like a lot of matcha, you know, being added to things where matcha doesn't belong.
The
green tea powder, Japanese green tea powder. Now you find it in croissants and...
Really?
You know,
why would you do that?
Oh, yeah. I know that that stuff is going on, but it's not really my... You know, I thought about when I was doing this book, like, I want my kids to be able to cook these recipes in 20 years and still have them be as rock solid as they are now.
You've done, obviously, cookbooks with others before and you've written for others before. What's it like... in being the main person on this book? Is that a different experience for you?
It's an entirely different experience. I sort of consider the co-authoring experience to be like method acting almost. And you know, for me, my first book was writing in the voice of a 45-year-old Vietnamese man who'd come to San Francisco when he was 12 years old.
Right.
And so... that's a challenge. You know, it's a challenge. It's almost more of a listening enterprise as much as it is a writing enterprise. For this one, I mean, it was hugely satisfying being able to tell sort of my own stories behind these recipes that I've loved for so long.
And there's some cussing in here, too, I will say, by the way.
Oh, I know. They wanted to take it out, but...
Really?
I think they were like, well, what if people want to make it with their kids? I'm like, well, then they definitely understand why you need to swear from time to time.
Also, don't read that part to your kids. I'm just saying.
Yeah, right.
You know, right? I mean, come on.
I know.
Jessica Badalana, the book is called Repertoire, and this is one of those. I'm just going to do full disclosure here. I'm taking this one home. I'm taking the copy home.
All right. I can't wait to hear what you cook.
Jessica, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Haven't cooked anything yet, by the way. We've pulled a couple of recipes and pictures from Jessica's book. It's called Repertoire. We put them on our website. Check them out, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, in which capitalism shows no mercy. Toys R Us, as you know, is bankrupt, shutting down its stores, liquidating its assets, closing things all the way down. That, of course, spells business opportunity for those so inclined. Should you be in possession of a Toys R Us gift card? Bed Bath & Beyond has a deal for you. It will take your soon-to-be-useless Toys R Us gift card and let you trade it in for one of theirs. Not, however, at full value. They are paying about 65 cents on the dollar. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 1.6% today, 389 points. NASDAQ up 1%, 71 points. S&P 500, 1.2% to the good, 32 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.